Welcome to the Fundraising Leadership Podcast, where we engage in lively and thoughtful conversations about the nonprofit sector. And I am Janice Cunning, and I'm here with my partner, Michelle Malloy-Dillon. And we're very excited to have Sally Helgeson join us. Sally is, according to Forbes, a world's premier expert on women's leadership. She's an internationally best-selling author, a speaker, and a leadership coach. And she's going to talk to us today about her new book, Rising Together, How We Can Bridge Divides and Create a More Inclusive Workplace. Welcome, Sally.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here. Thank you.
Yeah. We're excited to talk to you today about your book, and which offers some really practical ideas about inclusive behaviors people can take to create inclusive work cultures. So in your book, you identify some 8 common triggers that can undermine our ability to connect. And can you talk about some of those triggers?
Certainly. In Rising Together is really looking about the how of building inclusive organizations and inclusive cultures. I've been working with the whole concept of inclusion since I published the book, The Web of Inclusion, in 1995. So I've seen it go through lots of changes. And I think many of us are now fully bought into the why for inclusion, given the diversity of the workforce, and the diversity of those who benefit and those we're trying to reach. But the how is one of the things we struggle with. So what I have noticed in my coaching and the workshops that I've been doing for the last 20, 25 years all around the world is that when it comes to building relationships across a variety of boundaries, but in particular, I would say, around women and men. Now, maybe I'm just more alive to those because I do a lot of women's leadership workshops. But as I talk about triggers, I also get a lot of, for example, African-American males who will say, oh, yeah, that triggers me in the same kind of way. So what I've noticed is that certain things trigger us. I'll talk about a couple. One is visibility. That's a big one, where if you are someone who is not particularly skilled or assertive, if you're someone who's not particularly skilled and assertive about bringing attention to what your contributions are, then you can feel triggered by people who are really good at that, And so you're like, whoa, I don't want to be a showboat like that person, and then to yourself, you're thinking, I'm really a better person than he or she is. You're trying to make yourself feel better, but you can really be triggered by the attention someone else brings to what they contribute rather than, and the problem with that is that the trigger then prevents you from learning from that person. There may be ways in which they bring attention to their work. But you could put your own spin on them. I had the client eating out of my hand, they might say, and you could say, this client and I were really able to bond well. So you can frame things in a way that suits your temperament. But if you allow yourself to be triggered by the visibility of someone who's better at it, then you'll kind of remain stuck in your own story or narrative in your mind, which is that, they're always sucking up all the air and you don't want to be like them and life is unfair, wherever you want to take it. But that's really how a trigger operates. It's the narrative that keeps us stuck, the story we tell ourselves about why we're being triggered, instead of being able to just say, I think I'm being triggered here. This is uncomfortable. It's stirring up a lot of emotion. Let me sit with it and see how I can use that to move forward.
Yeah. I love that. It's, I always say to my coaching clients, it's like, once you have a perception of something, all we do as human beings is gather evidence to confirm the perception that we have of that.
You got it. The confirmation bias. Exactly. We dig into our own story. And The problem with that is it really keeps us stuck. It makes it hard to change. What I see about triggers is that when people are triggered, it can be visibility. It can be, you know, the trigger of feeling that you are merely that you're competent, but somebody else is getting favored because they're very confident. It can be the trigger around fairness, which is a huge one. You know, I was treated unfairly. I didn't get that promotion. I expected to get that promotion. They're only promoting men around here. They're only promoting women around here. They're only promoting minorities around here, whatever it is. You know, it's not fair. So we have the communication styles, big trigger, humor, of course, compliments, things like that. So when we feel ourselves, then getting into that, you know, gathering evidence, as you say, for all the reasons why this is unfair or we've been shortchanged or other people are, you know, not sensitive to what we contribute, all of that is just a way of getting stuck. And, you know, there's one other thing in organizations that I've witnessed for years. And that is that when we start to get that narrative, if we don't find a way to turn it around and give it a positive spin so we can move forward, we will often use it to bond with other people that we think will agree with that for us. You know, going up to grabbing somebody as we leave the meeting, you know, did you see that? You know, he reframed my idea. He's trying to steal it. He's trying to poach it. These guys just don't get it. That sort of thing. And then that creates a toxic atmosphere and puts us in kind of a gossip circle. Not productive.
Absolutely. Yeah, that culture of gossip can be completely toxic, as you say. And you mentioned that in order to establish a truly inclusive environment, we should focus on behaviors and actions. And we love the action in your book about honoring the squeaky wheel. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Certainly. Honoring the squeaky wheel means that deliberately including the person who has been kind of a troublemaker on a specific issue in either the meeting or the initiative or the team that is constituted in order to address that issue. This usually isn't done. We often keep the squeaky wheel out of the meeting, out of the initiative, because we figure, often rightly, that including them will make it harder to come to consensus, will probably make the meetings longer, et cetera. But it's a very good practice, not just to be inclusive toward the squeaky wheel, but because when we are able to come to consensus and the squeaky wheel is part of it, it is easier to sell that idea. I became familiar with this concept decades ago when I was doing one of the case studies for the Web of Inclusion. And I was studying the Miami Herald, which had had this very powerful and transformative fairness initiative. And one of the things they did very consciously was they tried to include the people who were the rabble-rousers on certain issues. You know, this one woman who was always moaning about, you know, women and how women were treated unfairly. The most outspoken Latino or Spanish-speaking person on the staff who felt that the Spanish-speaking part of the staff was treated unfairly. Whatever it was, whoever was the kind of troublemaker on the issue was included in the Fairness Task Force. And the publisher at that time, this magnificent man named Dave Lawrence, he said to me when I was interviewing about it, he said, we did that deliberately because we knew that once we had, if we could reach consensus, then people would say, well, you know, in this case, it was Janice. Well, if Janice went along with that, then, you know, they're probably serious. If they included Enrique, then they might really mean they're going to change things this time. Mm-hmm. So it gives you more work up front but less work trying to gain consensus in the larger organization around it, because those people are leaders on that issue. They're kind of prophetic voices that we want to include.
Yeah. You know, Michelle and I over the past few years have been doing, you know, team coaching training through an organization, ORSC, I know, Sally. And one of the concepts is deep democracy, which is exactly that. Like, how do we get every voice? But one of the things I find interesting is, like, they also talk about how oftentimes, even if that person who has been labeled, you know, quote unquote, the troublemaker or the rabble rouser leaves, someone else steps into that role, because it's like, actually, whatever that person is saying needs to be addressed. And until it's addressed, someone will just take that role on, right? So I just thought about that. And I was like, yeah, when you think about, like, places you've worked, you can see how that happens. It's like, well, if you haven't actually addressed an issue and made a change, then that voice of resistance is going to continue to be there because we're not honoring it. So that's why we were so excited when we saw you, because we were like, we don't talk about that enough, you know?
That's exactly right. And you know, what I try to do in my work is take things out of the theoretical. And honor, the squeaky wheel is not a theoretical concept. We all know the squeaky wheel in our neighborhood, whatever it is, you know, the one who's complaining about
the post office. I think I actually have been that squeaky wheel at certain places that I work.
Oh, yeah. I often take that role on. I agree.
Well, what I love about your example of the squeaky wheel and how the Miami Herald was handling it, it feels like, to have a metaphor around it, it feels like a foundation needs to be built with all the ingredients of the organization or the team or the neighborhood or whatever group is working together. And there needs to be some extra time and attention paid to how to go to put all those ingredients into the foundation, that buy-in, in order to be able to build a structurally sound team or building or whatever.
Yeah, that I strongly agree with that. And it's, you know, we get in for ourselves and our lives, but also in the work we do and with organizations, we get very focused on efficiency. And efficiency is associated with speed and with, you know, reliable outcomes and checking things off the list. I'm big on all that. But that efficiency can really undermine the long-term effectiveness, and the inclusion of the squeaky wheel and that commitment to making sure not only that all voices are heard, but that the people who care most passionately about an issue, that their perceptions are included, is an inherently inefficient process. And that's, I think, why we don't do it. One of the things in that Herald case study is that people talked about how long these meetings were and how they went on, and it was hard to remain patient. But at the end, everybody said it was so important because we really got to consensus. You know, I remember a number of years ago, I was on two committees that selected people. These are both for nonprofits. One selected small nonprofits for an award that came with a lot of development funding and opportunities that they couldn't ordinarily afford. The other was identifying scholarship students for a large women's group in New York. And what was interesting was that in the one that identified the scholarship students, we went to the meeting in New York. It lasted about an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours. Everybody was encouraged to bring their selections, checkmark selections, excuse me. And then we would sort of compile them and say, well, this one has 30 votes, this one has 16, whatever. And that's how we choose them. The other meeting lasted 6 hours, and we would talk through and achieve consensus. It was so much more satisfying. And what was interesting is when I went to the scholarship meeting, I'd have my ideas and, you know, I'd argue for them and that would be that. When I went to this other meeting, my ideas would change. They would evolve as I heard other people talking about why they thought this candidate was really important. They wouldn't have been on my list, but in the end, in coming to consensus. So I saw that it's a more creative process and it also bonds the people who are part of it.
Yeah. You know, it's making me think about my book club. Actually, I have my book club this weekend. And we were talking the other day about a few of us, like, we always ask at the beginning, did you like the book? And now we've started asking at the end of the meeting, did you like the book? There's six of us, you know, and sometimes it's like, eh. And then you talk about the book and you hear other people's like perspectives and what they got. And then you're like, I want to reread that book. It was amazing. You know, like, so that's sort of like a personal way of like, you know, like now I've come to be like, I don't really know how I feel about a book sometimes, you know, until I hear what other people's thoughts are about a book. Like, I'm more open now, you know, I must say that's very much in my mind because the book that I just read, I thought I was going to hate. And then I actually really liked it. So
well, I think it's a good comparison that you bring up. You know, once we hear, we really hear what other people think and their perceptions, that's an important, important thing to do. And that's, you know, with the squeaky wheel and that aiming for efficiency and let's make this meeting productive and, you know, get to the bottom line as quickly as we can and not waste people's time. That approach has its value, certainly, in some situations, but really when you're taking on, as the Herald was, for example, something as profound and large as fairness, how do we become a fair organization or an organization that has been perceived as profoundly unfair in the past? How do we do that? That's not a process that's going to benefit from efficiency. So
Yeah, and that process would look so different if it was a checklist. Check off the things that, you know, are important to you about fairness versus a human conversation around the depth of fairness and, you know, hearing each other's thoughts. It just feels like a very human connection that can result.
Yeah.
It is a very human connection. And that's why I think that so many of the arguments for AI are it'll be more efficient. We won't have this. We won't have that. We won't waste time on X, Y, and Z. In other words, we won't waste time on what's human. Okay. Mm-hmm.
It reminds me, Michelle, remember when Michelle and I did a leadership program, the same one at a different time, but they always used to say with people, slow is fast, you know, because it's like, yeah, again, that time to connect, to really listen to each other, to get to know each other. In the end, it does make it easier, you know, for a group of people to accomplish, you know, a task together. And I think, Sally, I'd love to segue, like, I think another thing that you have a very interesting viewpoint on, which my book club, again, is making me think about is authenticity, right? Because, again, it's like, in my mind, I looked at this book that my friend picked and was like, oh, that's not a book for me. That's not who I am. And then I enjoyed it, right? So talk about how authenticity sort of, it can get in the way, I think, of inclusion is maybe how you put it in the book.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we have been, you know, for the last 10 years or so, we've been hounded, it seems like, to be our authentic, bring our authentic selves to work, be our authentic selves in every possible situation. And, you know, first of all, you know, most of us, I mean, our authentic self is something that changes over time. I had views and opinions and ideas and commitments 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago that I do not have today, that I don't recognize. So it sort of presumes an unchanging definition of self, which those of us who seek to develop and grow over time do not really have. So that's one issue. The other issue is when it comes to inclusion, our authentic self may be, you know, someone who is uncomfortable with difference. So our authentic self may be at its core homophobic, racist. You know, we may be carrying ideas from our family of origin or from the people we grew up with that do not serve inclusion. So I think they're kind of at odds. Marshall talks about one of the things that really prevents people. Marshall Goldsmith, my colleague, really prevents people from growing is what he calls the excessive need to be me. And I think that's what, whenever I hear people talking about, you know, show up as your authentic self, that's what I'm thinking. It's really playing into that. But it's a problem for inclusion. Let me give an example. I was doing a podcast about 2 weeks ago, or it was a LinkedIn Live something, and we were talking about unconscious bias trainings and some of the problems with that, which I've been beating a drum about for a while. And this woman told me that she had been part of an unconscious bias training program at a consumer's product company when she was headed a sales team. She said there were 7 of us, 5 white guys and myself and an African-American man. She said, we went into the session and we were told, you know, you really want to be as real as you can. You want to be authentic in talking about uncovering where your unconscious biases are. And this woman, Lisa, who was interviewing me, said, you know, we sat in that session, she said, and when we heard how these white guys, she said it was in Alabama, when we heard how these white guys actually felt about working with women and working with Black people, she said, we could not unhear that. Mm-hmm. And it undermined the relationships that we had built. She said, and both the African-American guy, Todd, she said, he's my friend to this day, we left the company because we just couldn't get comfortable working with those people. And they had had good relationships before. So this is some of the damage that the authentic self urging can bring about. Because guess what? Give those guys time. They'll be working with more women. They'll be working with more people of color. And they'll probably get used to it. Their ideas will change, but this, you know, let's get real and be your authentic self and say whatever it is. You know, we're not in therapy. We're not in a group consciousness raising thing of the 70s. These are people we have to work with the next day. So I think that it's to some degree a kind of dangerous concept. And I see that a lot of people will justify very unprofessional behavior that undermines their colleagues or doesn't move a project forward based on, well, that's what I think. That's me. That's who I am. So, yeah, I don't think it's a completely helpful concept. Now, I understand one of the reasons it's gotten so, it's urged a lot. You know, there are a lot of people, I think particularly of gay people, of LGBTQ, who felt that they could not be their authentic selves at all and had to hide it in order to maintain their employment. And indeed, that was true. But, you know, we've swung in the other direction. And I don't think it's helpful to the conversation we're having.
Yeah, you have a phrase in the book which is like sort of aha moment, now what? And I think that's it's like we can both like look within ourselves and find those things for ourselves, and then the question is, you know, what do we do with it? And I think it, like, to me what also comes up is, as coaches, like, you know, we spend a lot of time, Michelle and I, you know, talking to clients about their values, because I think you can live your values in a way that your behavior still adapts, right? Like we work a lot with people who are direct in fundraising. And so it's like they get that, because when you go to meet with donors, you are adapting. You know, I mean, if you go, if you get invited, for example, to a donor's home and their spouse is there, that's a different conversation that they're inviting you into versus a donor like inviting you to come to their office for a meeting. And you're good, you know, you're going to show up in a different way. So I think, like, for our audience, it's very much like, you know, they're sort of used to that, like thinking about, like, I'm still bringing what I value. I'm still bringing, like, the purpose that I hold in the world, but I am able to, you know, sort of change my behavior to suit the situation that I know that I'm kind of being invited into. So I think, I think, like, people are going to find your book really interesting because I think it's sort of, like I said to you, I think before we hit record, I was like, this is what the nonprofit sector wants, right? Is to be inclusive. And I think now the question is, like, what do we actually do? So the last thing I think we wanted to have you talk a little bit about is this idea of informal enlistment that you bring in the book, because I think there's also some really practical ideas for people in that. So tell us more about what that is.
Well, you know, I've been working with informal enlistment for quite a while, and it applies very well to being able to build strong and effective relationships with people across a variety of boundaries. And basically what informal enlistment is, it is soliciting people to help us get better at what we feel our challenge is. So if we are struggling with the issue, say, of visibility, I'm going to go back to that one because it's really easy. It's self-explanatory almost. We're struggling with visibility, and there are a couple approaches to informal enlistment. We can say to someone, you know, I feel that I'm not doing a great job of getting recognized for what my contributions are. I mean, we can enlist anybody here, anybody who's going to, you know, in our work group. I feel like I'm not doing a very good job of this. I find myself feeling triggered by people who do a good job. And that's a warning signal for me. So in this particular meeting, you're going to be part of it. It can be on Zoom. It can be in person. You're going to be part of that meeting. And I've made a commitment to myself that I am going to share something that I've done, which I think is really valuable and I want people to know about. I feel awkward doing it. And I'd like your feedback afterwards, so that I can get better, so that I can get more comfortable. Now, when you do this, yes, it gives you information. The person gives you feedback, but there are a couple of real strong benefits. First of all, you're much more likely to do it because you've told someone you're going to do it. So then you suddenly don't do it. You feel like this response, oh, I don't feel like doing this, but I told her I was going to do it. So now I'm going to do it. So you, it's a way of holding yourself to account. You've demonstrated that you're somebody who is committed to getting better at what you're doing. You have made a move to bring that person in as a potential ally. You know, all those, you're kind of advertising the fact that you're trying to change. And that's important because often when we're in an organization or we're working with a particular group, kind of coast on our reputation from before. Oh yeah, she sits in the back of the room all the time. She's the one, she doesn't speak up. Well, you moved to the front of the room 6 months ago, but nobody has noticed. So when you do this sort of thing, you know, you say, I am going to speak up, I'm going to get better at this, you're advertising. It doesn't just have to work that way. Another form of informal enlistment can be, and this is really helpful, take the same kind of example where of the visibility. You go up to a colleague, somebody you don't know, this can be someone very different from you, and say, you know, do you have a moment? I'd like to ask your advice. Sure. I'm trying to get better at talking about my contributions and getting acknowledged for them. You are very skillful at doing that, and it's something that I would like to learn from. Do you have anything you do? Is there anything you do, you know, any preparation, anyone you talk to, anything you think about, any mantra that you have that has made you so skilled at this that might be helpful for me to know about? Now, what this does, who's going to say, well, no, you know, I don't. I mean, people are flattered. They're happy to, you know, have you acknowledge what they think they're good at and what they are good at. So that person may give you some very helpful advice. You know, this is something that I think about in preparation. This is how I prepare. That's helpful. But also you have, you know, kind of pull that person in as a potential ally. So if they see you in a meeting and you kind of flub something or you, you know, get off on a tangent, then they may come up to you and say, you know, you're making real progress here, but I noticed that one thing you did in that meeting was X, and I would advise that you do this. So then you've got this kind of, it's like on the spot mentoring engagement that you're pulling them into. And the important things are to be really specific and to, you know, probably put a time limit on it. So they're not thinking, oh, so this is my new role. I'm going to be mentoring.
For the rest of my life, I'm going to be. Right?
You know, but, you know, be very specific and let them know. Yeah. It's a question about this applying to this situation. And it is really, really, and getting in a habit of doing that. I worked with it on How Women Rise because so many women have this perfection trap. It's really good for perfectionists because you are speaking aloud what you're not good at and, you know, sort of engaging with people instead of having to have sort of all the details taken care of before you try to do anything.
Well, I love the word ally that you used because you're also building an ally in that situation and also building trust with someone. Right. In, you know, asking for their feedback and their advice for a specific situation, it creates a different kind of relationship and support if it's something that you're trying to get better at.
You know, the trust thing is very important because that's part of what you're doing. You're saying, I trust you with this disclosure of my own vulnerability. And what's important is because you're putting a kind of limit on this. You don't even need to feel like, oh, I really, really trust this person, so I'm going to ask them. It doesn't matter. You can kind of do this with most people, unless there's someone who you really know that you cannot trust. You have evidence on that. But you're making the trustful overture and seeing if you can elicit a trustful relationship in response.
Yeah. It feels like it supports also the idea that, like, we were talking about with authenticity, that you are growing and changing. You are not like static. So, you know, it also, it feels like you're sort of rebranding yourself, you know, a person at a time. So, yeah. So lots of great conversation, Sally. We love to end with like something that people could try. So what's something tangible and specific that you would like to give to our listeners that they could put into practice at work?
It's a practice I've had great luck with in coaching and in workshops, and that is working with people to rewrite a narrative. So a very simple story that we may tell ourselves, you know, I didn't get that promotion and he did. Because he plays the game. I didn't get that promotion and he did because he's part of an old boys network that I really don't have access to. So we're telling ourselves a story about why someone got a promotion and we didn't. In this instance, you can use this for all kinds of things. And we're guessing to some extent. So rather than stay dug into that story, the best way around it is to try to rewrite that narrative and begin to move forward based on that. For example, if somebody's gotten that promotion, you can go to that person and say, you know, I expected to get that promotion. And it's been disappointing and kind of hard to deal with. And I want to know why, but you know, I accept it and I want to work with you and I want to support you. And I'm wondering if there was something that I missed, some reason, something, some skill you demonstrated, some connections you had, some way in which you demonstrated that you had the competence and were, could be trusted to do this job, because that will help me think about how I'm positioning myself going forward. It would be very useful to have this information. So it's a form of informal enlistment here. And then that opens a conversation with that person about, you know, and you want to make very clear that you're completely accepting of this, but you're trying to get more information about why they may have been chosen. So then you can sort of rewrite your own script from, you know, it's fundamentally unfair, or the old boys network strikes again, which doesn't give you a path forward. You're not going to upend the old boys network and smash that. You're not going to unseat this person. So you have no path forward. So here your path forward is, number one, potentially engaging that person as an ally, and then thinking through your narrative can be, I'm beginning to see that one reason I may not have gotten this promotion is I am not perceived of as, you know, having certain client connections or being assertive enough about reaching out to clients, whatever it is, whatever that person says. Now, you don't have to believe this. You don't have to believe it, but it gives you a way to engage that person as an ally. Maybe even say, you know, I need to get better at that. I hope to move on. I have skills that I think are not getting leveraged and recognized where I am. But that's very useful information to me. So if you see an instance where I'm not, you know, where I'm not engaging the clients in the way that you did, whatever the person says, let me know. So now your script becomes that you are working to get better in these couple areas, and you want to solicit support and allies who can help you develop those areas and also bring attention and visibility to what you're trying to do. So you have a new script. It can also be something very, very simple. You know, I can't believe that guy reframed what I said in that meeting. And, you know, he's trying to poach my idea, or, you know, people only really listen to the men when they say something. We can feel that way, but we can also quickly rewrite that script to ourselves and say, well, maybe he was trying to frame what I said in a way that other people could hear. Maybe he didn't hear me at all, and we both had that same idea. So you can rewrite that script for yourself. And then go up to that person afterwards and say, hey, you know what? I'm glad to hear that you agree with what I said about such and such. I'm wondering, maybe there's a way we could talk about potentially collaborating on this. So then again, it's giving someone the benefit of your goodwill in order to be able to move forward and create a path for positive action.
Yeah, my brain is filled with metaphors today. So I'm thinking of bridge, like building a bridge of connection, of getting some more information. Like there's all these different ways that you're mentioning of building a bridge to try to keep that human dialogue going back and forth.
Yeah, and that word bridge is in the subtitle of Rising Together very intentionally, how we can bridge divides to create a more inclusive workplace.
Thank you, Sally. Thank you for this wonderful conversation and for your great book. And go out and buy the book. It's filled with lots of wonderful stuff.
Rising Together. Yes. Thank you. Thank
you,
Michelle.
We will link to the book in the show notes so everyone can easily find the book if they're interested in getting it.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed our conversation too.
So this podcast is brought to you by Fundraising Leadership. We provide unique coaching and training programs to grow nonprofit leaders. Please subscribe if you haven't already, and you can find us wherever you listen to podcasts. If you're enjoying the show, you can help us continue to bring thoughtful content with a one-time contribution. This supports our production costs and keeps the show ad-free. Contribute today using the link in the show notes, and you'll receive one or more of our highly acclaimed online courses. Now go put it into practice. Yeah.